So David, thank you very much for coming, and here you are.
Thank you. Okay, I must say I am particularly thrilled by this gathering. I'm hoping it may turn out to be a landmark event that we'll all look back on as an important turning point in our region and perhaps more broadly. That's pretty ambitious, but I'm just kind of swept away by what an extraordinary group we have here in this room. I'm very conscious from my own experience of how a group of us no larger than this got together back in 1994 and began a conversation about the deeper dynamics of economic globalization and its impact on the world. This was back when that was a new issue. And it was a group from all over the world, but people like yourselves who were in positions of influence and really thinking deeply about the issues of the time. As we went back out through the world, we were able to ignite a conversation that then led to such things as the demonstration that we had, the powerful demonstration here in Seattle in 1999. So I'm very aware of the dynamics of how these things can unfold, and we are at a moment when we need exactly that kind of breakthrough in thinking and in the public conversation. Now, I believe we're all here for the same reason. We recognize we are in deep crisis, not only on economics, but on many, many different fronts, and that it is time for action, and that we are committed to being part of the solution. So just in quick overview, climate disruption is accelerating. International institutions are now announcing food shortages. They're not going to be temporary. With massive government and Federal Reserve subsidies, Wall Street and its Phantom Wealth Casino are doing very well, making ever more and more money for the richest people in the world. Well, globally, billions of people continue to struggle for survival. Here in the United States, millions face job loss, foreclosure, and bankruptcy. And our economic and political institutions are showing no signs of a capacity to deal with the real issues. Our nation's most prominent instrument for dealing with a related social failure is the prison system, another sign of deep failure. And these consequences are being felt by persons of every faith and every congregation, mosque, synagogue, and they're being felt by our clergy and by the institutions themselves, sometimes facing bankruptcy and foreclosure. All of this, of course, is creating deep psychological stresses. And as you know better than I, many of our mainstream churches are losing membership, perhaps partly a result of this stress, perhaps partly people not finding them as relevant to their lives as they once did. This is the context of our challenge. There's an imperative for action. But the leadership's not going to come from Washington, D.C., and it's certainly not going to come from the institutions of Wall Street. It's got to come from people like us, and particularly the institutions of the faith community. And that's why I'm so excited about this gathering. How many of you heard President Obama's State of the Union address a couple of nights ago? Anybody else notice here the underlying theme of global competition? That we got to prepare ourselves and our children to compete with those Indians and those Chinese because either we get the jobs or they get the jobs. You know, at one level, I believe he was speaking to the current psyche of the American people, which reveals a sense of what deep trouble we're in. But every time I hear that kind of message, I just want to know, why can't we create an economy that works for everybody? And that's the challenge we now have to confront. Cooperation, sharing, material sufficiency, and spiritual abundance are our only hope for a livable human future. We cannot resolve the crisis as it is unfolding through competition. No way. And we all know that. And it's so obvious if you just simply put it forward. And 99% of the people in the world, I believe, can understand that. The future of society depends on rediscovering and reclaiming the prophetic mission of our faith institutions. Humanity stands at a moral choice point, because fundamentally the underlying issues are moral issues. Our collective future depends on a spiritual awakening that transcends the individual faith traditions. Now, I believe that awakening is happening, but it's at a far slower pace than our times require, because it has no identifiable institutional support, and it faces determined opposition from the forces of fear and greed. This is a moment for the institutions of our various faith traditions to discover their common spiritual roots and mobilize to embrace, deepen, and accelerate the awakening and the action that must flow from that awakening. So how many of you remember the historic 1999 WTO demonstrations? I assume that most of you were engaged in some way, and including in the build-up within the faith community in the Seattle area that was part of the key to the success of that event. And how many of you were at the conference on global economic justice that was sponsored by the Seattle Washington State Council of Churches just about a month before that? You may recall Marcus Borg and I were speakers at that conference. And you know, those demonstrations disrupted the negotiations of the WTO. They inspired subsequent protests all around the world that ultimately thwarted the effort of the WTO to use multilateral trade agreements to place corporate power beyond public accountability. It was a truly historic moment. I like to think of that as potential inspiration. You know, this faith community had a major role in instigating that. We now have a new challenge to instigate something much larger, ultimately, and much deeper. Our economic institutions are the link between our nation's moral crisis and virtually every failing system that threatens the future of humanity. And my charge today is to share with you how I think about that link between the moral crisis and the economic, social, and environmental crisis now playing out. So I want to start by going back to that conference on global economic justice, because that was a key pivotal moment for me personally, for the very reason that that was where I met Marcus Borg and became exposed to his foundational message that I have never forgotten and never will. Tell me your image of God and I will tell you your politics. Patriarch or spirit? Out there or everywhere? The spirit image awakens our realization that creation unfolding is a manifestation of an integral spiritual intelligence on a creative journey of self-discovery. It inspires us to discover our human place of service in that creative unfolding, and to create a world that nurtures the expression of the spirit in its distinctive human manifestation. Now, once we recognize ourselves as expressions of the divine, we can see that the divine isn't a parent figure out there to whom we can appeal to save us from ourselves. It is the Spirit manifest in all that acts through us. Now, I would lay odds that it is the Spirit image that animates the work of each person in this room. And yet none of us can be totally sure that the rest share that with ourselves because we so rarely discuss it in those terms. That, to me, is part of recognizing the source of our spiritual crisis. There's an enormous insight I find in a classic spiritual verse. You all know it, Christian or non-Christian, I'm sure. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. Ye cannot serve God and mammon. Now this verse translates for me to a choice between serving the spirit of life or serving the institutions of money. It happens to be a Christian verse, but do we know of any faith tradition that teaches that we should put money before life? I do believe it is a universal. Now, this foundational moral principle, this foundational truth, goes to the heart of explaining the profound failure of our economy and our society. And it's very easy to understand. We have created a system of economic institutions that put service to money ahead of service to life. You don't need a PhD in economics to understand it, and in fact, you probably understand it much more easily if you don't have a PhD in economics. Now, these institutions, these economic institutions, are both manifestation and cause of the moral corruption of society. And a measure of the failure of our religious institutions to fulfill their prophetic mission. Because our religious institutions and teachers have allowed academic economists to become the primary arbiters of society's values, and have stood idly by as these institutions and academics corrupted the moral culture of the society. The economics of market fundamentalism is an immoral and illogical ideology based on the premise that money is the standard by which to value life and to assess the performance of our economy, our government, our education, and even our religions. How many of our churches judge their success by the size of their collections, financial collections? And how many of them bend their message to appeal to those who are likely to contribute the most money to the institution? You know, that's just one manifestation of this larger issue. It's extraordinary how this economic ideology has turned basic ethical principles on their head. They have literally drawn us to believe that greed is a virtue and that sharing is a sin. Now, I would guess that most of us here believe that greed's a sin and sharing's a virtue, right? Anybody? I mean, this is what's so astounding about the nature of the issues. They are so obvious. And they are so fundamentally contradictory to what we all know in our heart. And here is the foundation of the prophetic role of our faith institutions: to bring the truth, the moral truth, to the fore of societal consciousness. You know, just take, you know, as a practical matter. You know, we measure economic performance by GDP. Growing GDP has become the defining purpose of our society. GDP largely measures two things. One is the rate at which we're taking useful resources and converting them to toxic garbage to make money for the very rich. And, oh, we're getting richer. Yeah. Literally destroying life to turn it into money, which is nothing but a number, an accounting entry sitting someplace in a computer. It has no existence outside of the human mind. Just a number. Yet we worship it as the ultimate totem of modernization and progress. The other thing that GDP measures is the rate at which we are monetizing human relationships. Every time we buy something rather than doing it for ourselves, every time we go to the marketplace rather than sharing among ourselves and our neighbors, we're growing the economy. Yeah, I became very conscious of this in my work abroad because, you know, the World Bank and the IMF talk about how much progress we've made. We got people up to $1 a day or $2 a day income. Well, very often, those are people who are living much better on a subsistence existence where they had no need for money, didn't use money, but their subsistence existence has been stripped away, the means of their subsistence, and so they become dependent on money, and so they're forced into slums and sweatshops and so forth to earn that dollar. And we celebrate, oh, they're better off. Not really. So by focusing on economic growth and growth in GDP, we actively celebrate, as a society, the destruction of God's creation as our faith institutions watch from the sidelines. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission found Wall Street excesses and the regulatory failure caused by the financial The Crisis Inquiry Commission found that Wall Street excess and regulatory failure caused the financial crash. At a deeper level, we might say that the crash was the product of a failure of our religious institutions to provide society's needed values compass. So are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? To out the moral corruption of a failed economic ideology? Are you prepared to go head-to-head, toe-to-toe with the academic economists and tell them, you got it wrong? You don't understand economics? Are we ready to transform the public's understanding of our economic institutions? It's really interesting. We as a nation are captive to a grand illusion. The design of our economic institutions is based on an illusion. The illusion that money is wealth. And that by making money, we create wealth. That's why we celebrate Wall Street. They're making lots of money. They're making us richer. You know, all they're doing is pumping up those accounting entries, inflating artificial values of financial assets. Now, money is a very useful human institution, but only when we use it as a means rather than as an ends or a purpose. Treating the creation of money as a sacred purpose of society is an act of insanity and moral perversion, as is the practice of creating money as treating money as the defining resource constraint in meeting the needs of those for whom our current economy offers no opportunity. We cannot help the poor because we don't have enough money. And yet we have idle resources all around, and we have idle people all of whom are sitting around waiting to be put to work with somebody coming up with some money. As a society, money should never be the defining constraint, because all we need is an accounting entry. And if you've been following what's been going on in terms of the Wall Street revelations, we know that since the financial crash, the Federal Reserve has created something on the order of $13 trillion simply with accounting entries to pump up and save the Wall Street banks, while much of the rest of the society goes unemployed and faces foreclosures. Now, we need a whole new economic framework. Tom Thresher and I were talking on the way over here on the boat about, we need a new economics that is based in foundational faith values. We need to really start the whole rethinking almost over again. Now, it's time to fulfill the charge of the spiritual teachers throughout the ages. Create the societies devoted to mutual love, caring, and the service of life that we know in our hearts is possible. Now, the broad outline, the book that we have here, The Agenda for a New Economy, I wrote following the financial crash, and it's specifically about the response to that crash. And in the second edition, I lay out three simple elements of the change strategy. One, change the framing story of the culture to create awareness in the society of love and caring that is ours to create. Essentially penetrating the lies that frame our current understanding of what's socially possible, so we can begin to see the possibility before us. Two is to make this new society a reality by living it into being. That's the practical action. The third is change the rules of public policy to support the moral economy over the immoral economy. Now, I'm going to say more about these, but I want to give you a little bit more of the framework for thinking about the economy that we need to create. The way I think about this in big terms is our current system basically, from living system terms, mimics a cancer. Cancer cell seeks its own unlimited growth, undifferentiated growth, without concern, without recognition of the consequences for the larger body on which its very survival depends. That's essentially the metaphor of our global corporation. They are the instruments for converting the real wealth of society into money. We need to create an economic system that mimics Earth's biosphere, which is rooted and self-reliant everywhere. It's almost the mirror image opposite of the global economy. In system terms, we need to design the institutions of this economy so that they self-organize toward financial stability, ecological balance, shared prosperity, and living democracy. That sound okay? Financial stability, earth balance, shared prosperity, and living democracy, engaged democracy. Now, achieving these conditions requires a transformation of the economic system's defining value from money to life, the locus of power from global financial markets to local communities, to transform the predominant dynamic from competition to cooperation, and redefine its defining ethic from externalizing costs onto the rest of the society to embracing responsibility for the consequences of our actions for others. That's the fun. You see very clearly the moral element in this. Now, you can break it down. I think, to me, there are seven primary institutional sources of the current economic dysfunction. And this is key because, this is not just about a shift in individual values or awakening of individual values. That also has to translate into some very profound institutional restructuring. And that's the piece we often miss, because we cannot change the institutions individually. We can only change the institutions through collective action. And here again is where our faith institutions are a primary mechanism through which we have the potential to do that. So, seven primary interventions. Well, let me first of all, I'll go through the key institutional sources of the dysfunction, and then I'll get to the alternatives. First source of dysfunction is the use of financial indicators like GDP and stock market indices to assess the performance of the economy. And of course, you know, we're seeing that more clearly. The economy's growing, but jobs aren't. The Dow Jones is going up, but wages aren't. Foreclosures continue. It's not a valid measure. Second problem. It's the Wall Street control of the creation and allocation of money. That invisible number that defines the power system of the society. And particularly as we have moved to where we have monetized more and more of our human relationships, we never notice that that gives more and more power to the people who control the creation and allocation of money. Very simple, foundational piece of understanding. Another source of dysfunction, fiscal policies that support extreme and growing inequality in the distribution of income and ownership. Aren't we also glad that we've restored the tax breaks for the very rich? So they can continue to accumulate way beyond the rest of us. Another source of dysfunction is the system of absentee ownership, most clearly personified in the publicly traded corporation, that separates the power of decision-making from its social and environmental consequences. The use of corporate charters to create global-scale, legally protected concentrations of economic power under unified management to advance narrow and exclusive private interests beyond the reach of public accountability. Our fragmented and dependent local economies that leave people dependent for their livelihoods and outside interests over which they have no control. You know, depending on the other side of the world for more and more of our food supply. You know, that doesn't help those farmers who actually need their food themselves to eat, but it's very beneficial to the global corporations that control global food trade. And of course, we have global rules that support all of these dysfunctions. That's what the WTO is about. So these translate. We've got to flip each one of these around to translate them into seven essential positive structural changes. We need to replace financial indicators like GDP with indicators of human and natural systems health as the basis for evaluating economic performance. Maybe you heard the discussion here about the Bhutan happiness indicator. That's cool. That is really cool. We need to decentralize and democratize the money system and redirect so that it redirects money from financial speculators and Wall Street to real businesses and people on Main Street. And most of us in this room grew up at a time when we actually had a system of local banks that were locally rooted and primarily served local needs. But the whole process of deregulation has transformed that into a system that instead of supporting the creation of community wealth is like a huge global vacuum cleaner sucking the wealth out of communities. So there's nothing esoteric about this. Much of that is simply going back to something that looks rather much like what we actually had. We need tax and fiscal and employment policies that distribute income and ownership equitably to achieve a democratic distribution of power and real wealth. That's actually foundational to both market principles and obviously to a democracy. Equitable societies, we're also learning, are happier, healthier, more democratic, and avoid the excesses of extravagance and desperation. We need to favor locally rooted ownership by real people who have a direct stake in the social and environmental consequences of the firm's operation. People who are looking not for a maximum financial return, but for a living return that includes a healthy community and a healthy natural environment. We actually need to create real markets and real democracy by freeing up both the market and our political system from domination by corporate monopolies that are both anti-democratic and anti-market. It's amazing how this gets flipped around so that we forget what the real nature of a market economy is, and it is not an economy ruled by Goldman Sachs, Walmart, and Monsanto. We need to pursue local economic development programs that build diversified, self-reliant, energy-efficient, democratically self-organizing local economies. So this is again something that each of our faith institutions can contribute to. And we need to restructure those global rules so that they support real living wealth, positive moral principles. So I expect you can see the epic nature of the challenge that this puts before us. This is not small. It's about changing everything. But I believe that we have come to a moment in the human experience in which this is both possible and imperative. The fact it is imperative is part of what makes it possible, but we also now have the understanding and the communications technologies to make decisions as a species to achieve the systemic changes that are essential to our future. So, coming back to the three elements of the change strategy, change the framing stories of the culture. Here's where there's an enormous role for our sermons, for adult education programs in our faith institutions, for organizing all kinds of community conversations to bring in front and center the value dimension around our policy choices and our public discourse. Two, live a new reality into being by supporting our local economies, supporting local entrepreneurs, helping reweave the systems of relationships between enterprises in our food systems, our money systems, our building systems, all the aspects of our lives. And Seattle is at the forefront of this. I mean, the initiative of the Seattle City Council to move us toward food self-reliance is a powerful frame for a first step in this move. And three, change the rules. Of course, that's what the City Council is doing here. But we need to align ourselves behind rules and policies that support the deep change we need. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Thank you.